Chapter 41. Friend's Blood. The next morning, I woke early, washed up, and grabbed a bite to eat at the mess. Then, because I had nothing to do before my whipping at noon, I strolled the university aimlessly. I wandered through a few apothecaries and bottle shops, admired the well-kept lawns and gardens. Eventually, I came to rest on a stone bench in a wide courtyard. Too anxious to think of doing anything productive, I simply sat and enjoyed the weather, watching the wind tumble a few scraps of waste paper along the cobblestones. It wasn't too long before Willem strolled over and sat himself next to me without an invitation. His characteristic sealed-ish dark hair and eyes made him seem older than Simon and me, but he still had the slightly awkward look of a boy who wasn't quite used to being man-sized yet.
"Nervous?"
he asked with the harsh burr a Siaru accent makes.
"Trying not to think about it, actually," I said.
Willem grunted. We were both quiet for a minute while we watched the students walk past. A few of them paused in their conversations to point at me. I quickly grew tired of their attention.
"Are you doing anything right now?"
"Sitting," he said simply. "Breathing."
"Clever. I can see why you're in the Arcanum. Are you busy for the next hour or so?"
He shrugged and looked at me expectantly.
"Would you show me where Master Arwell is? He told me to stop by. After."
"Certainly," he said, pointing to one of the courtyard's outlets. "Medica is on the other side of archives."
We made our way around the massive windowless block that was the archives. Willem pointed.
"That is Medica."
It was a large, oddly shaped building. It looked like a taller, less rambling version of Maine's.
"Bigger than I thought it would be," I mused. "All for teaching medicine?"
He shook his head.
"They do much business in tending the sick. They never turn anyone away because they can't pay."
"Really?" I looked at Medica again, thinking of Master Arwell. "That's surprising."
"You need not pay in advance," he clarified. "After you recover..."
He paused, and I heard the clear implication, "if you recover."
"You settle accounts. If you have no hard coin, you work until your debt is..."
He paused.
"What is the word for shame?"
he asked, holding out his hands with the palms up and moving them up and down as if they were the pans of a scale.
"Wade?" I suggested.
He shook his head.
"No. Shayim."
He stressed the word and brought his hands even with each other.
"Oh,"
I mimicked the gesture.
"Balanced."
He nodded.
"You work until your debt is balanced with the Medica. Few leave without settling their debts."
I gave a grim chuckle. "Not that surprising. What's the point of running away from an arcanist who has a couple drops of your blood?" We eventually came to another courtyard. In the center of it was a pennant pole with a stone bench underneath it. I didn't need to guess who was going to be tied to it in an hour or so. There were about 100 students milling around, giving things an oddly festive air.
"It's not usually this big,"
Willem said apologetically,
"but a few masters canceled classes."
"Hem, I'm guessing. And Brandur?" Willem nodded.
"Hem holds grudges."
He paused to give emphasis to his understatement.
"He'll be there with his whole coterie."
He pronounced that last word slowly.
"Is that the right word? Coterie?"
I nodded, and Willem looked vaguely self-satisfied. Then he frowned.
"That makes me remember something strange in your language. People are always asking me about the road to Tinue. Endlessly they say, 'How is the road to Tinue?' What does it mean?"
I smiled. "It's an idiomatic piece of the language. That means..."
"I know what an idiom is,"
Willem interrupted.
"What does this one mean?"
"Oh," I said slightly embarrassed. "It's just a greeting. It's kind of like asking, 'How was your day?' or 'How is everything going?'"
That is also an idiom, Willem grumbled. Your language is thick with nonsense. I wonder how any of you understand each other. How is everything going? Going where?
He shook his head. Tinue, apparently. I grinned at him.
Tu an volgen okef ama, I said, using one of my favorite Siaru idioms. It meant, don't let it make you crazy, but it translated literally as, don't put a spoon in your eye over it.
We turned away from the courtyard and walked around the university aimlessly for a while. Willem pointed out a few more notable buildings, including several good taverns, the alchemy complex, the Sealedish laundry, and both the sanctioned and unsanctioned brothels. We strolled past the featureless stone walls of the archives, past a cooper, a bookbinder, an apothecary. A thought occurred to me. Do you know much herb lore? He shook his head.
Chemistry mostly, and I dabble in archives with puppets sometimes.
Dabble, I said, emphasizing the b sound for him. Dapple is something else. Who's puppet?
Will paused.
Hard to describe.
He waved a hand to dismiss the question.
I'll introduce you later. What do you need to know about herbs?
Nothing, really. Could you do me a favor? He nodded, and I pointed to the nearby apothecary. Go buy me 2 scruples of gnarl root. I held up 2 iron drabs. This should cover it.
Why me?
He asked warily. Because I don't want the fellow in there giving me the
you're awfully young look.
I frowned. I don't want to have to deal with that today. I was nearly dancing with anxiety by the time Willem got back.
He was busy,
he explained, seeing the impatient expression on my face. He handed me a small paper packet and a loose jingle of change.
What is it?
It's to settle my stomach, I said. Breakfast isn't sitting too well, and I don't fancy throwing up halfway through being whipped. I bought a cider at a nearby pub, using mine to wash down the gnarl root, trying not to grimace at the bitter, chalky taste. Before too long, we heard the belling tower striking noon.
I think I must go to class.
Will tried to mention it nonchalantly, but it came out almost strangled. He looked up at me, embarrassed, and a little pale under his dark complexion.
I am not fond of blood.
He gave a shaky smile.
My blood, friend's blood.
I don't plan on doing much bleeding, I said, but don't worry. You've gotten me through the hard part, the waiting. Thank you. We parted ways, and I fought down a wave of guilt. After knowing me less than 3 days, Will had gone out of his way to help me. He could have taken the easy route and resented my quick admittance into the Arcanum as many others did. Instead, he had done a friend's duty, helping me pass a difficult time, and I had repaid him with lies. As I walked toward the pennant pole, I felt the weight of the crowd's eyes on me. How many were there? 200? 3? After a certain point is reached, the numbers cease to matter, and all that remains is the faceless mass of a crowd. My stage training held me firm under their stares. I walked steadily toward the pennant pole amid a sea of susurrous murmurings. I didn't carry myself proudly, as I knew that might turn them against me. I was not repentant, either. I carried myself well, as my father had taught me, with neither fear nor regret on my face. As I walked, I felt the gnarl root begin to take firm hold of me. I felt perfectly awake while everything around me grew almost painfully bright. Time seemed to slow as I approached the center of the courtyard. As my feet came down on the cobblestones, I watched the small puffs of dust they raised. I felt a breath of wind catch the hem of my cloak and curl underneath to cool the sweat between my shoulder blades. It seemed for a second that should I wish to, I could count the faces in the crowd around me like flowers in a field. I spotted none of the masters in the crowd except for him. He stood near the pennant pole, looking pig-like in his smugness. He folded his arms in front of himself, letting the sleeves of his black master's robe hang loosely at his sides. He caught my eye, and his mouth quirked up into a soft smirk that I knew was meant for me. I resolved that I would bite out my own tongue before I gave him the satisfaction of appearing frightened or even concerned. Instead, I gave him a wide, confident smile, then looked away, as if he didn't concern me in the least. Then I was at the pennant pole. I heard someone reading something, but the words were just a vague buzzing to me as I removed my cloak and lay it across the back of a stone bench that sat at the base of the pole. Then I began to unbutton my shirt, as casually as if I were preparing to take a bath. A hand on my wrist stopped me. The man that had read the announcement gave me a smile that tried to be comforting.
"You don't need to go shirtless," he said. "It'll save you from a bit of the sting."
"I'm not going to ruin a perfectly good shirt," I said. He gave me an odd look, then shrugged and ran a length of rope through an iron ring above our heads.
"I'll need your hands."
I gave him a flat look. "You don't need to worry about my running off."
"It's to keep you from falling over if you pass out."
I gave him a hard look. "If I pass out, you may do whatever you wish," I said firmly. "Until then, I will not be tied." Something in my voice gave him pause. He didn't offer me any argument as I climbed onto the stone bench beneath the pole and stretched to reach the iron ring. I gripped it firmly with both hands. Smooth and cool, I found it oddly comforting. I focused on it as I lowered myself into the heart of stone. I heard people moving away from the base of the pole. Then the crowd quieted, and there was no sound but the soft hiss and crack of the whip being loosened behind me. I was relieved I was to be whipped with a single-headed whip. In Tarbian, I had seen the terrible, bloody hash a six-tail can make of a man's back. There was a sudden hush. Then, before I could brace myself, there came a sharper crack than the ones before. I felt a line of dim red fire trace down my back. I gritted my teeth. But it wasn't as bad as I'd thought it would be. Even with the precautions I had taken, I expected a sharper, fiercer pain. Then the second lash came. Its crack was louder, and I heard it through my body rather than with my ears. I felt an odd looseness across my back. I held my breath, knowing I was torn and bleeding. Everything went red for a moment, and I leaned against the rough, tarred wood of the pennant pole. The third lash came before I was ready for it. It licked up to my left shoulder, then tore nearly all the way down to my left hip. I grit my teeth, refusing to make a sound. I kept my eyes open and watched the world grow black around the edges for a moment before snapping back into sharp, bright focus. Then, ignoring the burning across my back, I set my feet on the bench and loosened my clenched fingers from the iron ring. A young man jumped forward as if he expected to have to catch me. I gave him a scathing look, and he backed away. I gathered my shirt and cloak, laid them carefully over one arm, and left the courtyard, ignoring the silent crowd around me.
Chapter 42. Bloodless.
"It could be worse, that much is certain."
Master Arwill's round face was serious as he circled me.
"I was hoping you would simply welt, but I should have known better with your skin."
I sat on the edge of a long table deep inside the medica. Arwill prodded my back gently as he chattered on.
"But as I say, it could be worse. Two cuts, and as cuts go, you couldn't have done better. Clean, shallow, and straight. If you do as I tell you, you'll have nothing but smooth silver scars to show the ladies how brave you are."
He stopped in front of me and raised his white eyebrows enthusiastically behind the round rings of his spectacles.
"Eh?"
His expression wrung a smile from me. He turned to the young man that stood by the door.
"Go and fetch the next Raelar on the list. Tell them only that they are to bring what is needful to repair a straight, shallow laceration."
The boy turned and left, his feet pattering away in the distance.
"You will provide excellent practice for one of my Raelar,"
Arwill said cheerfully.
"Your cut is a good straight one, with little chance of complication, but there is not much to you."
He prodded my chest with a wrinkled finger and made a tisk noise with his tongue against his teeth.
"Just bones and a little wrapping. It is easier for us if we have more meat to work with." "But,"
he shrugged, bringing his shoulders almost to his ears and back down,
"things are not always ideal. That is what a young physicker must learn more than anything."
He looked up at me as if expecting a response. I nodded seriously. It seemed to satisfy him, and his squinting smile returned. He turned and opened a cabinet that stood against one of the walls.
"Give me just a moment, and I will numb the burning that must be all across your back."
He clinked a few bottles together as he rummaged around on its shelves. "It's all right, Master Arwill," I said stoically. "You can stitch me closed the way I am." I had two scruples of gnaw root numbing me, and I knew better than to mix anesthetics if I could avoid it. He paused with one arm deep into the cabinet and had to withdraw it to turn and look at me.
"Have you ever had stitches before, my boy?"
"Yes," I said honestly.
"Without anything to soften the pain?"
I nodded again. As I sat on the table, my eyes were slightly higher than his. He looked up at me skeptically.
"Let me see, then,"
he said, as if he didn't quite believe me. I pulled my pant leg up over my knee, gritting my teeth as the motion tugged on my back. Eventually, I revealed a handspan worth of scar on my outer thigh above my knee from when Pike had stabbed me with his bottle-glass knife back in Tarbian. Arwill looked at it closely, holding his glasses with one hand. He gave it one gentle prod with his index finger before straightening.
"Sloppy,"
he pronounced with a mild distaste. "I had thought it was a rather good job." "My cord broke halfway through," I said stiffly. "I wasn't working under ideal circumstances." Arwill was silent for a moment, stroking his upper lip with a finger as he watched me through half-lidded eyes.
"And do you enjoy this sort of thing?"
he asked dubiously. I laughed at his expression, but it was cut short when dull pain blossomed across my back. "No, master. I was just taking care of myself as best I could." He continued looking at me, still stroking his lower lip.
"Show me where the gut broke."
I pointed. "It isn't the sort of thing that you forget." He gave the old scar a closer examination and prodded it again before looking up.
"You may be telling me the truth."
He shrugged.
"I do not know, but I would think that if..."
He trailed off and peered speculatively into my eyes. Reaching up, he pulled one of the lids back.
"Look up,"
he said perfunctorily. Frowning at whatever he saw, Arwill picked up one of my hands, pressed the tip of my fingernail firmly, and watched intently for a second or two. His frown deepened as he moved closer to me, took hold of my chin with one hand, opened my mouth, and smelled it.
"Tennyson?"
he asked, then answered his own question.
"No. Gnarl root, of course. I must be getting old not to notice it sooner. It also explains why you're not bleeding all over my nice clean table."
He gave me a serious look.
"How much?"
I didn't see any way of denying it. Two scruples. Arwill was silent for a while as he looked at me. After a moment, he removed his spectacles and rubbed them fiercely against his cuff. Replacing them, he looked straight at me.
"It is no surprise that a boy might fear a whipping enough to drug himself for it."
He looked sharply at me.
"But why, if he was so afraid, would he remove his shirt beforehand?"
He frowned again.
"You will explain all of this to me,
If you've lied to me before, admit it, and all will be well. I know boys tell foolish stories sometimes."
His eyes glittered behind the glass of his spectacles.
"But if you lie to me now, neither I nor any of mine will stitch you. I will not be lied to."
He crossed his arms in front of himself.
"So, explain. I do not understand what is going on here. That, more than anything else, I do not like."
My last resort, then. The truth. "My teacher, Abinthy, taught me as much as he could about the physicker's arts," I explained. "When I ended up living on the streets of Tarbian, I took care of myself." I gestured to my knee. "I didn't wear my shirt today because I only have 2 shirts, and it has been a long time since I've had as many as that."
"And the gnarl root?" he asked.
I sighed. "I don't fit in here, sir. I'm younger than everyone, and a lot of people think I don't belong. I upset a lot of students by getting into the Arcanum so quickly, and I've managed to get on the wrong side of Master Hem. All those students, and Hem and his friends, they're all watching me, waiting for some sign of weakness." I took a deep breath. "I took the gnarl root because I didn't want to faint. I needed to let them know they couldn't hurt me. I've learned that the best way to stay safe is to make your enemies think you can't be hurt." It sounded ugly to say it so starkly, but it was the truth. I looked at him defiantly. There was a long silence as Arwill looked at me, his eyes narrowing slightly behind his spectacles, as if he were trying to see something inside me. He brushed his upper lip with his finger again before he began slowly to speak.
"I suppose if I were older," he said quietly enough to be speaking to himself, "I would say that you are being ridiculous, that our students are adults, not squabbling, bickersome boys."
He paused again, still stroking his lip absent-mindedly. Then his eyes crinkled upward around the edges as he smiled at me.
"But I am not so old as that. Not yet. Not by half. Anyone who thinks boys are innocent and sweet has never been a boy himself or has forgotten it. And anyone who thinks men aren't hurtful and cruel at times must not leave his house often. And he has certainly never been a physicker. We see the effects of cruelty more than any other."
Before I could respond, he said, "Close your mouth, Iliac Voth, or I will feel obliged to put some vile tonic in it.
Ah, here they come."
The last was said to 2 students entering the room. One was the same assistant who had shown me here. The other was, surprisingly, a young woman.
"Ah, Rela Mola," Arwill enthused,
all signs of our serious discussion passing lightly from his face.
"You have heard that your patient has 2 straight, clean lacerations. What have you brought to remedy the situation?"
"Boiled linen, hook needle, gut, alcohol, and iodine," she said crisply. She had green eyes that stood out in her pale face.
"What?" Arwill demanded. "No sympathy wax?"
"No, Master Arwill," she responded, paling a little at his tone.
"And why not?"
She hesitated.
"Because I don't need it."
Arwill seemed mollified.
"Yes, of course you don't. Very good. Did you wash before you came here?"
Mola nodded, her short blonde hair bobbing with the motion of her head.
"Then you have wasted your time and effort," he said sternly. "Think of all the germs of disease that you might have gathered in the long walk through the passageway. Wash again, and we will begin."
She washed with a thorough briskness at a nearby basin. Arwill helped me lay face down on the table.
"Has the patient been numbed?" she asked. Though I couldn't see her face, I heard a shadow of doubt in her voice.
"Anesthetized," Arwill corrected. "You have a good eye for detail, Mola. No, he has not. Now, what would you do if Ilir Kvoth reassured you that he has no need for such things? He claims to have self-control like a bar of Ramsden steel and will not flinch when you stitch him.
Arwell's tone was serious, but I could detect a hint of amusement hiding underneath. Mola looked at me, then back to Arwell. "I would tell him he was being foolish," she said after a brief pause. "And if he persisted in his claims that he needed no numbing agent?" There was a longer pause from Mola. "He doesn't seem to be bleeding much at all, so I would proceed. I would also make it clear to him that if he moved over much, I would tie him to the table and treat him as I saw fit for his well-being." Arwell seemed a little surprised at her response.
"Yes, very good. So, Kvothe, do you still want to forego an anesthetic?"
"Thank you," I said politely. "I do not need one." "Very well," Mola said, as if resigning herself. "First, we will clean and sterilize the wound." The alcohol stung, but that was the worst of it. I tried my best to relax as Mola talked her way through the procedure. Arwell kept up a steady stream of comments and advice. I occupied my mind with other things and tried not to twitch at the null-root-dulled jabs of the needle. She finished quickly and proceeded to bandage me with a quick efficiency I admired. As she helped me to a sitting position and wound linen around me, I wondered if all Arwell students were as well-trained as this one. She was making her final knots behind me when I felt a vague, feather-like touch on my shoulder, almost insensible through the null root that numbed me. "He has lovely skin," I heard her muse, presumably to Arwell.
"Rela," Arwell said severely. "Such comments are not professional. I am disappointed by your lack of sense."
"I was referring to the nature of the scar he can expect to have," she responded scathingly. "I imagine it will be little more than a pale line, provided he can avoid tearing open his wound."
Arwell said. "Yes, of course. And how should he avoid that?"
Mola walked around to stand in front of me. "Avoid motions like this." She extended her hands in front of her. "Or this." She held them high over her head. "Avoid over-quick motions of any kind, running, jumping, climbing. The bandage may come off in 2 days. Do not get it wet." She looked away from me to Arwell. He nodded.
"Very good, Rela. You are dismissed."
He looked at the younger boy, who had watched mutely throughout the procedure.
"You may go as well, Gary. If anyone asks, I will be in my study. Thank you."
In a moment, Arwell and I were alone again. He stood motionless, one hand covering his mouth as I eased my way carefully into my shirt. Finally, he seemed to reach a decision.
"Elia Kvothe, would you like to study here at the Medica?"
"Very much so, Master Arwell," I said honestly. He nodded to himself, hand still held against his lips.
"Come back in 4 days. If you are clever enough to keep from tearing out your stitches, I will have you here."
His eyes twinkled. Chapter 43. The Flickering Way. Buoyed by the stimulant effects of the null root and feeling very little pain, I made my way to the archives. Since I was now a member of the Arcanum, I was free to explore the stacks, something I'd been waiting my whole life to do. Better still, so long as I didn't ask for any help from the Scrivs, nothing would be recorded in the Archives' ledger books. That meant I could research the Chandrian and the Aemir to my heart's content, and no one, not even Lauren, need ever know about my childish pursuits. Entering the reddish light of the Archives, I found both Ambrose and Fella sitting behind the entry desk. A mixed blessing, if ever there was one. Ambrose was leaning toward her, speaking in a low voice. She had the distinctly uncomfortable look of a woman who knows the futility of a polite refusal. One of his hands rested on her knee, while the other arm was draped across the back of her chair, his hand resting on her neck. He meant for it to look tender and affectionate, but there was a tension in her body like that of a startled deer. The truth was, he was holding her there, the same way you hold a dog by the scruff of its neck to keep it from running off. As the door thumped closed behind me, Fella looked up, met my eyes, then looked down and away, ashamed by her predicament, as if she'd done anything. I had seen that look too many times on the streets of Tarbian. It sparked an old anger in me. I approached the desk, making more noise than necessary. Pen and ink lay on the other end of the desk, and a piece of paper, three-quarters full of rewriting and crossing out. From the looks of things, Ambrose had been trying to compose a poem. I reached the edge of the desk and stood for a moment. Fella looked everywhere except at me or Ambrose. She shifted in her seat, uncomfortable, but obviously not wanting to make a scene. I cleared my throat pointedly. Ambrose looked over his shoulder, scowling. "You have damnable timing, Ilir. Come back later." He turned away again, dismissing me. I snorted and leaned over the desk, craning my neck to look at the sheet of paper he'd left lying there. "I have damnable timing? Please. You have 13 syllables in a line here." I tapped a finger onto the page. "It's not iambic, either. I don't know if it's anything metrical at all." He turned to look at me again, his expression irritated. "Mind your tongue, Ilir. The day I come to you for help with poetry is the day you have 2 hours to spare," I said. "Two long hours, and that's just for getting started. So same can the humble thrush well know its north? I mean, I don't even know how to begin to criticize that. It practically mocks itself." "What do you know of poetry?" Ambrose said without bothering to turn around. "I know a limping verse when I hear it," I said. "But this isn't even limping. A limp has rhythm. This is more like someone falling down a set of stairs. Uneven stairs. With a midden at the bottom." "It is a sprung rhythm," he said, his voice stiff and offended. "I wouldn't expect you to understand." "Sprung?" I burst out with an incredulous laugh. "I understand that if I saw a horse with a leg this badly sprung, I'd kill it out of mercy, then burn its poor corpse for the fear the local dogs might gnaw on it and die." Ambrose finally turned around to face me, and in doing so, he had to take his right hand off Fella's knee. A half-victory. But his other hand remained on her neck, holding her in her chair with the appearance of a casual caress. "I thought you might stop by today," he said with a brittle cheerfulness. "So I already checked the ledger. You're not in the lists yet. You'll have to stick with Tomes or come back later, after they've updated the books." "No offense, but would you mind checking again? I'm not sure I can trust the literacy of someone who tries to rhyme north with worth. No wonder you have to hold women down to get them to listen to it." Ambrose stiffened, and his arm slid off the back of the chair to fall at his side. His expression was pure venom. "When you're older, Ilir, you'll understand that what a man and a woman do together..." "What? In the privacy of the entrance hall of the archives?" I gestured around us. "God's body, this isn't some brothel. And in case you haven't noticed, she's a student, not some brass nail you've paid to bang away at. If you're going to force yourself on a woman, have the decency to do it in an alleyway. At least that way she'll feel justified screaming about it." Ambrose's face flushed furiously, and it took him a long moment to find his voice. "You don't know the first thing about women." "There, at least, we can agree," I said easily. "In fact, that's the reason I came here today. I wanted to do some research, find a book or two on the subject." I struck the ledger with two fingers, hard. "So look up my name and let me in." Ambrose flipped the book open, found the proper page, and turned the book around to face me. "There. If you can find your name on that list, you are welcome to peruse the stacks at your leisure." He gave a tight smile. "Otherwise, feel free to come back in a span or so. We should have things updated by then." I had the master send along a note just in case there was any confusion about my admission to the Arcanum, I said, and drew my shirt up over my head, turning so he could see the broad expanse of bandages covering my back. Can you read it from there, or do I have to come closer? There was a pointed silence from Ambrose, so I lowered my shirt and turned to face Fella, ignoring him entirely. My Lady Scriv, I said to her with a bow, a very slight bow, as my back wouldn't permit a deep one. Would you be so good as to help me locate a book concerning women? I have been instructed by my betters to inform myself on this most subtle subject. Fella gave a faint smile and relaxed a bit. She had continued sitting stiff and uncomfortable after Ambrose had taken his hand away. I guessed that she knew Ambrose's temperament well enough to know that if she bolted away and embarrassed him, he would make her pay for it later.
I don't know if we have anything like that.
I would settle for a primer, I said with a smile. I have it on good report that I don't know the first thing about them, so anything would further my knowledge. Something with pictures, Ambrose spat. If our search degenerates to that level, I'll be sure to call on you, I said without looking in his direction. I smiled at Fella. Perhaps a bestiary, I said gently. I hear they are singular creatures, much different than men. Fella's smile blossomed, and she gave a small laugh.
We could have a look around, I suppose.
Ambrose scowled in her direction. She made a placating gesture toward him.
Everyone knows he's in the Arcanum, Ambrose, she said. What's the harm of just letting him in?
Ambrose glared at her.
Why don't you run along to Tomes and play the good little fetch-and-carry girl? He said coldly. I can handle things out here by myself.
Moving stiffly, Fella got up from the desk, gathered up the books she'd been trying to read, and headed into Tomes. As she pulled the door open, I like to think she gave me a brief look of gratitude and relief, but perhaps it was only my imagination. As the door swung shut behind her, the room seemed to grow a little dimmer. I am not speaking poetically. The light truly seemed to dim. I looked at the sympathy lamps hanging around the room, wondering what was wrong. But a moment later, I felt a slow burning sensation begin to creep across my back and realize the truth. The gnawlroot was wearing off. Most powerful painkillers have serious side effects. Tennyson occasionally produces delirium or fainting. Lacillium is poisonous. Ophalum is highly addictive. Manka is perhaps the most powerful of all, but there are reasons they call it devil root. Gnawlroot was less powerful than these, but much safer. It was a mild anesthetic, a stimulant, and a vascular constrictor, which is why I hadn't bled like a stuck pig when they'd whipped me. Best of all, it had no major side effects. Still, there is always a price to be paid. Once gnawlroot wears off, it leaves you physically and mentally exhausted. Regardless, I had come here to see the stacks. I was now a member of the Arcanum, and I didn't intend to leave until I'd been inside the archives. I turned back to the desk, my expression resolute. Ambrose gave me a long, calculating look before heaving a sigh.
Fine, he said. How about a deal? You keep quiet about what you saw here today, and I'll bend the rules and let you in, even though you aren't officially in the book.
He looked a little nervous. How does that sound? Even as he spoke, I could feel the stimulant effects from the gnawlroot fading. My body felt heavy and tired. My thoughts grew sluggish and syrupy. I reached up to rub at my face with my hands and winced as the motion tugged sharply at the stitches all across my back.
That'll be fine, I said thickly.
Ambrose opened up one of the ledger books and sighed as he turned the pages.
Since this is your first time in the archives proper, you'll have to pay the stack fee.
My mouth tasted strangely of lemons. That was a side effect Ben had never mentioned.
It was distracting, and after a moment, I saw that Ambrose was looking up at me expectantly.
What?
He gave me a strange look. The stack fee?
There wasn't any fee before, I said, when I was in the tomes.
Ambrose looked up at me as if I were an idiot.
That's because it's the stack fee.
He looked back down at the ledger. Normally, you pay it in addition to your first term's Arcanum tuition, but since you've jumped rank on us, you'll need to tend to it now.
How much is it?
I asked, feeling for my purse. 1 talent, he said, and you do have to pay before you can go in. Rules are rules. After paying for my bunk and mews, 1 talent was nearly all my remaining money. I was keenly aware of the fact that I needed to hoard my resources to save for next term's tuition. As soon as I couldn't pay, I would have to leave the university. Still, it was a small price to pay for something I dreamed about for most of my life. I pulled 1 talent out of my purse and handed it over.
Do I need to sign in?
Nothing so formal as that, Ambrose said as he opened a drawer and pulled out a small metal disc. Stupefied from the side effects of the Nalrut, it took me a moment to recognize it for what it was, a handheld sympathy lamp.
The stacks aren't lit, Ambrose said matter-of-factly. There's too much space in there, and it would be bad for the books in the long term.
Hand lamps cost 1 talent and a half. I hesitated. Ambrose nodded to himself and looked thoughtful. A lot of folk end up strapped during the first term. He reached down into a lower drawer and rooted around for a long moment. Hand lamps are 1 talent and a half, and there's nothing I can do about that. He brought out a 4-inch taper. But candles are just 1/2. Halfpenny for a candle was a remarkably good deal. I brought out 1 penny.
I'll take 2.
This is our last one, Ambrose said quickly. He looked around nervously before pushing it into my hand. Tell you what, you can have it for free. He smiled. Just don't tell anyone. It'll be our little secret. I took the candle, more than a little surprised. Apparently, I'd frightened him with my idle threat earlier. Either that or this rude, pompous, noble son wasn't half the bastard I'd taken him for. Ambrose hurried me into the stacks as quickly as possible, leaving me no time to light my candle. When the door swung shut behind me, it was as black as the inside of a sack, with only a faint hint of reddish sympathy light coming from around the edges of the door behind me. As I didn't have any matches with me, I had to resort to sympathy. Ordinarily, I could have done it quick as blinking, but my Nalrut-weary mind could barely muster the necessary concentration. I gritted my teeth, fixed the ailer in my mind, and after a few seconds, I felt the cold leach into my muscles as I drew enough heat from my own body to bring the wick of the candle sputtering to life. Books. With no windows to let in the sunlight, the stacks were utterly dark except for the gentle light of my candle. Stretching away into the darkness were shelf on shelf of books. More books than I could look at if I took a whole day. More books than I could read in a lifetime. The air was cool and dry. It smelled of old leather, parchment, and forgotten secrets. I wondered idly how they kept the air so fresh in a building with no windows. Cupping a hand in front of my candle, I made my flickering way through the shelves, savoring the moment, soaking everything in. Shadows danced wildly back and forth across the ceiling as my candle's flame moved from side to side. The Nalrut had worn off completely by this point. My back was throbbing, and my thoughts were leaden, as if I had a high fever or had taken a hard blow to the back of the head. I knew I wasn't going to be up for a long bout of reading, but I still couldn't bring myself to leave so soon, not after everything I'd gone through to get here. I wandered aimlessly for perhaps 1/4 hour, exploring.
I discovered several small stone rooms with heavy wooden doors and tables inside. They were obviously meant as a place where small groups could meet and talk without disturbing the perfect quiet of the archives. I found stairwells leading down as well as up. The archives was 6 stories tall, but I hadn't known it extended underground as well. How deep did it go? How many tens of thousands of books were waiting under my feet? I can hardly describe how comforting it was in the cool, quiet dark. I was perfectly content, lost among the endless books. It made me feel safe, knowing that the answers to all my questions were here, somewhere waiting. It was quite by accident that I found the 4-plate door. It was made of a solid piece of gray stone, the same color as the surrounding walls. Its frame was 8 inches wide, also gray, and also one single seamless piece of stone. The door and frame fit together so tightly that a pin couldn't slide into the crack. It had no hinges, no handle, no window or sliding panel. Its only features were 4 hard copper plates. They were set flush with the face of the door, which was flush with the front of the frame, which was flush with the wall surrounding it. You could run your hand from one side of the door to the next and hardly feel the lines of it at all. In spite of these notable lacks, the expanse of gray stone was undoubtedly a door. It simply was. Each copper plate had a hole in its center, and though they were not shaped in the conventional way, they were undoubtedly keyholes. The door sat still as a mountain, quiet and indifferent as the sea on a windless day. This was not a door for opening. It was a door for staying closed. In its center, between the untarnished copper plates, a word was chiseled deep into the stone. Veleritas. There were other locked doors in the university. Places where dangerous things were kept. Where old and forgotten secrets slept, silent and hidden. Doors whose opening was forbidden. Doors whose thresholds no one crossed. Whose keys had been destroyed or lost or locked away themselves for safety's sake. But they all paled in comparison to the 4-plate door. I lay my palm on the cool, smooth face of the door and pushed, hoping against hope that it might swing open to my touch. But it was solid and unmoving as a gray stone. I tried to peer through the holes in the copper plates, but couldn't see anything by the light of my single candle. I wanted to get inside so badly I could taste it. It probably shows a perverse element of my personality that even though I was finally inside the archives, surrounded by endless secrets, that I was drawn to the one locked door I had found. Perhaps it is human nature to seek out hidden things. Perhaps it is simply my nature. Just then I saw the red, unwavering light of a sympathy lamp approaching through the shelves. It was the first sign I'd seen of any other students in the archives. I took a step back and waited, thinking to ask whoever was coming what was behind the door, what Veleritas meant. The red light swelled, and I saw 2 scrivs turn a corner. They paused. Then one of them bolted to where I stood and snatched my candle away, spilling hot wax on my hand in the process of extinguishing it. His expression couldn't have been more horrified if he had found me carrying a freshly severed head.
"What are you doing with an open flame in here?"
he demanded in the loudest whisper I had ever heard. He lowered his voice and waved the now extinguished candle at me.
"Charred body of God! What's the matter with you?"
I rubbed at the hot wax on the back of my hand, trying to think clearly through the fog of pain and exhaustion. Of course, I thought, remembering Ambrose's smile as he pressed the candle into my hands and hurried me through the door. Our little secret. Of course. I should have known. One of the scrivs led me out of the stacks, while the other ran to fetch Master Lauren. When we emerged into the entryway, Ambrose managed to look confused and shocked. He overacted the part,
but it was convincing enough for the Scriv accompanying me. What's he doing in here?
We found him wandering around, the Scriv explained, with a candle.
What?
Ambrose's expression was perfectly aghast.
Well, I didn't sign him in, Ambrose said.
He flipped open one of the ledger books.
Look, see for yourself.
Before anything else could be said, Lauren stormed into the room. His normally placid expression was fierce and hard. I felt myself sweat cold, and I thought of what Tekum wrote in his Theophany. There are three things all wise men fear: the sea in storm, a night with no moon, and the anger of a gentle man. Lauren towered over the entry desk.
Explain,
he demanded of the nearby Scriv. His voice was a tight coil of fury.
Micah and I saw a flickering light in the stacks, and we went to see if someone was having trouble with their lamp. We found him near the southeast stairwell with this.
The Scriv held up the candle. His hand shook slightly under Lauren's glare. Lauren turned to the desk where Ambrose sat.
How did this happen, Relar?
Ambrose raised his hands helplessly. He came in earlier, and I wouldn't admit him because he wasn't in the book. We bickered for a while. Fella was here for most of it. He looked at me. Eventually, I told him he'd have to leave. He must have snuck in when I went into the back room for more ink. Ambrose shrugged. Or maybe he slipped in past the desk in tomes.
I stood there, stupefied. What little part of my mind wasn't leaden with fatigue was preoccupied with the screaming pain across my back.
That's not true. I looked up at Lauren. He let me in. He sent Fella away, then let me in.
What?
Ambrose gaped at me, momentarily speechless. For all that I didn't like him, I must give him credit for a masterful performance.
Why in God's name would I do that?
Because I embarrassed you in front of Fella, I said. He sold me the candle, too. I shook my head, trying to clear my head. No, he gave it to me. Ambrose's expression was amazed.
Look at him, he laughed. The little cocker is drunk or something.
I was just whipped, I protested. My voice sounded shrill in my own ears.
Enough,
Lauren shouted, looming over us like a pillar of anger. The Scrivs went pale at the sound of him. Lauren turned away from me and made a brief, contemptuous gesture toward the desk.
Relar Ambrose is officially remanded for laxity in his duty. What?
Ambrose's indignant tone wasn't feigned this time. Lauren frowned at him, and Ambrose closed his mouth. Turning to me, he said,
Ilir Kvoth is banned from the archives.
He made a sweeping gesture with the flat of his hand. I tried to think of something I could say in my defense. Master, I didn't mean...
Lauren rounded on me. His expression, always so calm before, was filled with such a cold, terrible anger that I took a step away from him without meaning to.
You mean, he said, I care nothing for your intentions, Ilir Kvoth, deceived or otherwise. All that matters is the reality of your actions. Your hand held the fire. Yours is the blame. That is the lesson all adults must learn.
I looked down at my feet, tried desperately to think of something I could say, some proof I could offer.
My leaden thoughts were still plodding along when Lauren strode out of the room.
I don't see why I should be punished for his stupidity, Ambrose groused to the other Scrivs as I made my way numbly to the door.
I made the mistake of turning around and looking at him. His expression was serious, carefully controlled, but his eyes were vastly amused, full of laughter.
Honestly, boy, he said to me, I don't know what you were thinking. You'd think a member of the Arcanum would have more sense.
I made my way to the mess,
the wheels of my thoughts turning slowly as I plodded along. I fumbled my meal chit into one of the dull tin trays and collected a portion of steamed pudding, a sausage, and some of the ever-present beans. I looked dully around the room until I spotted Simon and Manette sitting in their usual place at the northeast corner of the hall. I drew a fair amount of attention as I walked to the table. Understandable, as it was scarcely 2 hours since I'd been tied to the pennant pole and publicly lashed. I heard someone whisper, "Didn't bleed when they whipped him. I was there. Not one drop." It was the null root, of course. It had kept me from bleeding. It had seemed like such a good idea at the time. Now it seemed petty and foolish. Ambrose would never have managed to gull me so easily if my naturally suspicious nature hadn't been fuddled. I'm sure I could have found some way to explain things to Lauren if I'd had my wits about me. As I made my way to the far corner of the room, I realized the truth. I had traded away my access to the archives in exchange for a little notoriety. Still, there was nothing to do but make the best of it. If a bit of reputation was all I had to show for this debacle, I'd have to do my best to build on it. I kept my shoulders straight as I made my way across the room to Simon and Manette and set down my food. "There's no such thing as a stack fee, is there?" I asked quietly as I slid into my seat, trying not to grimace at the pain across my back. Sim looked up at me blankly. "Stack fee?" Manette chortled into his bowl of beans. "It's been a few years since I've heard that. Back when I worked as a scriv, we'd trick the first-termers into giving us a penny to use the archives. Called it a stack fee." Sim gave him a disapproving look. "That's horrible." Manette held up his hands defensively in front of his face. "Just a little harmless fun." Manette looked me over. "Is that what your long face is for? Somebody call you for a copper?" I shook my head. I wasn't going to announce that Ambrose had tricked me out of a whole talent. "Guess who just got banned from the archives?" I said gravely as I tore the crust off my bread and dropped it into my beans. They looked at me blankly. After a moment, Simon took the obvious guess. "You?" I nodded and began to spoon up my beans. I wasn't really hungry, but I hoped a little food in my stomach might help shake off the sluggishness of the null root. Besides, it went against my nature to pass up an opportunity for a meal. "You got suspended on your first day," Simon said. "That's going to make studying your Chandrian folklore a whole lot harder." I sighed. "You could say that." "How long did he suspend you for?" "He said banned," I answered. "He didn't mention a time limit."
"Banned?"
Manette looked up at me.
"He hasn't banned anyone in a dozen years. What'd you do? Piss on a book?"
Some of the scrivs found me inside with a candle.
"Merciful Talu!"
Manette lay down his fork, his expression serious for the first time.
"Old Lore must have been furious."
"Furious is exactly the right word," I said. "What possessed you to go in there with an open flame?" Simon asked. "I couldn't afford a hand lamp," I said, "so the scriv at the desk gave me a candle instead."
"He didn't," Sim said.
"No scriv would..." "Hold on," Manette said. "Was this a dark-haired fellow? Well-dressed? Severe eyebrows?"
He made an exaggerated scowl. I nodded tiredly. "Ambrose. We met yesterday. Got off on the wrong foot."
"He's hard to avoid," Manette said carefully, with a significant look to the people sitting around us.
I noticed that more than a few were casually listening to our conversation.
"Someone should have warned you to keep clear of him," he added in a softer tone.
"God's mother," Simon said, "of all the people you don't want to start a pissing contest with." "Well, it's been started," I said. I was starting to feel a little more like myself again, less cotton-headed and weary, Either the side effects of the gnaw root were fading, or my anger was slowly burning away the haze of exhaustion. He'll find out I can piss along with the best of them. He'll wish he'd never met me, let alone meddled with my affairs.
Simon looked a little nervous.
You really shouldn't threaten other students, he said with a little laugh, as if trying to pass my comment off as a joke. More softly, he said, You don't understand. Ambrose is heir to a barony off in Ventus. He hesitated, looking at Manette. Lord, how do I even start?
Manette leaned forward and spoke in more confidential tones as well.
He's not one of those nobility who dabble here for a term or two, then leave. He's been for years, climbed his way up to Raylar. He's not some seventh son, either. He's the firstborn heir, and his father is one of the 12 most powerful men in all of Ventus.
Actually, he's 16th in the peerage, Sim said matter-of-factly. You've got the royal family, the prince regents, Mayor Alvaron, Duchess Semista, Aculeus, and Meluin Lackless. He trailed off under Manette's glare.
He has money, Manette said simply, and the friends that money buys.
And people who want to curry favor with his father, Simon added.
The point is, Manette said seriously, you don't want to cross him. Back in his first year here, one of the alchemists got on Ambrose's bad side. Ambrose bought his debt from the moneylender in Imre. When the fellow couldn't pay, they clapped him into debtor's prison.
Manette tore a piece of bread in half and daubed butter on it.
By the time his family got him out, he had lung consumption. Fellow was a wreck. Never came back to his studies.
And the masters just let this happen? I demanded.
All perfectly legal, Manette said, still keeping his voice low. Even so, Ambrose wasn't so silly that he bought the fellow's debt himself.
Manette made a dismissive gesture.
He had someone else do that, but he made sure everyone knew he was responsible.
And there was Tabitha, Sim said darkly. She made all that noise about how Ambrose had promised to marry her. She just disappeared. This certainly explained why Fella had been so hesitant to offend him. I made a placating gesture to Sim. I'm not threatening anyone, I said innocently, pitching my voice so anyone who was listening could easily hear. I'm just quoting one of my favorite pieces of literature. It's from the fourth act of Deonica, where Tarsus says, Upon him I will visit famine and a fire, till all around him desolation rings, and all the demons in the outer dark look on amazed and recognize that vengeance is the business of a man. There was a moment of stunned silence nearby. It spread a bit farther through the mess than I'd expected. Apparently, I'd underestimated the number of people who were listening. I turned my attention back to my meal and decided to let it go for now. I was tired, and I hurt, and I didn't particularly want any more trouble today.
You won't need this piece of information for a while, Manette said quietly after a long period of silence. What with being banned from the archives and all. Still, I'm supposing you'd rather know.
He cleared his throat uncomfortably.
You don't have to buy a hand lamp. You just sign them out at the desk and return them when you're done.
He looked at me as if anxious about what sort of reaction the information might provoke. I nodded wearily. I'd been right before. Ambrose wasn't half the bastard I thought he was. He was 10 times the bastard.
Chapter 44. The Burning Glass. The fishery was where most of the university's works of hands were made. The building held shops for glass blowers, joiners, potters, and glaziers. There was also a full forge and smelt works that would figure prominently into any metallurgist's daydreams. Kilvin's workshop was located in the artificery, or, as it was more commonly called, the fishery. It was big as the inside of a granary, holding at least 2 dozen thick-timbered work tables strewn with countless, nameless tools and projects in progress.
The workshop was the heart of the fishery, and Kilvin was the heart of the workshop. When I arrived, Kilvin was in the process of bending a twisted length of iron rod into what I could only assume was a more desirable shape. Seeing me peering in, he left it firmly clamped to the table and walked to meet me, wiping his hands on his shirt. He looked me over critically.
"Are you well, Ilir Kvoth?"
I'd gone wandering earlier and found some willow bark to chew. My back still burned and itched, but it was bearable. "Well enough, Master Kilvin." He nodded.
"Good. Boys your age shouldn't worry over such small things. Soon again you will be as sound as stone."
I was trying to think up a polite response when my eye was drawn to something over our heads. Kilvin followed my gaze up over his shoulder. When he saw what I was looking at, a grin split his great bearded face.
"Ah," he said with fatherly pride, "my lovelies."
High among the high rafters of the workshop, a 500 glass spheres hung from chains. They were of varying sizes, though none were much larger than a man's head. And they were burning. Seeing my expression, Kilvin made a gesture.
"Come,"
he said, and led me to a narrow stairway made of wrought iron. Reaching the top, we stepped out onto a series of slim iron walkways 25 feet above the ground, weaving their way among the thick timbers that supported the roof. After a moment of maneuvering through the maze of timber and iron, we came to a hanging row of glass spheres with fires burning inside them.
"These," Kilvin gestured, "are my lamps."
It was only then that I realized what they were. Some were filled with liquid and wicking, much like ordinary lamps, but most of them were utterly unfamiliar. One contained nothing but a boiling gray smoke that flickered sporadically. Another sphere contained a wick hanging in empty air from a silver wire, burning with a motionless white flame despite its apparent lack of fuel. Two hanging side by side were twins, save that one had a blue flame and the other was a hot forge orange. Some were small as plums, others large as melons. One held what looked like a piece of black coal and a piece of white chalk, and where the two pieces were pressed together, an angry red flame burned outward in all directions. Kilvin let me look for a long while before he moved closer.
"Among the Kjeldar, there are legends of ever-burning lamps. I believe that such a thing was once within the scope of our craft. 10 years I have been looking. I have made many lamps, some of them very good, very long-burning."
He looked at me.
"But none of them ever-burning."
He walked down the line to point at one of the hanging spheres.
"Do you know this one, Ilir Kvoth?"
It held nothing but a knob of greenish-grayish wax that was burning with a greenish-grayish tongue of flame. I shook my head.
You should. White lithium salt. I thought of it 3 span before you came to us. It is good so far. 24 days, and I expect many more."
He looked at me.
"You're guessing this thing surprised me, as it took me 10 years to think of it. Your second guess, sodium oil, was not as good. I tried it years ago. 11 days.
He moved all the way to the end of the row, pointing at the empty sphere with the motionless white flame.
70 days, he said proudly. "I do not hope that this will be the one, for hoping is a foolish game. But if it burns 6 more days, it will be my best lamp in these 10 years.
He watched it for a while, his expression oddly soft.
"But I do not hope," he said resolutely. "I make new lamps and take my measurements. That is the only way to make progress."
Wordlessly, he led me back down to the floor of the workshop. Once there, he turned to me.
"Hands," he said in a peremptory way.
He held out his own huge hands expectantly. Not knowing what he wanted, I raised my hands in front of me. He took them in his own, his touch surprisingly gentle. He turned them over, looking at them carefully.
"Do you have Kjeldar hands?"
he said in a grudging compliment. He held his own up for me to see.
They were thick-fingered with wide palms. He made two fists that looked more like mauls than bald hands.
I had many years before these hands could learn to be Keldar hands. You are lucky. You will work here.
Only by the quizzical tilting of his head did he make the gruff grumble of a statement into an invitation.
Oh, yes. I mean, thank you, sir. I'm honored that you...
He cut me off with an impatient gesture.
Come to me if you have any thoughts on the ever-burning lamp. If your head is as clever as your hands look...
What might have been a smile was hidden by his thick beard, but a grin shone in his dark eyes as he hesitated teasingly, almost playfully.
If,
he repeated, holding up a finger, its tip as large as the ball of a hammer's head.
Then me and mine will show you things.
You need to figure out who you're going to suck up to, Simmons said. A master has to sponsor you to Relar, so you should pick one and stick to him like shit on a shoe.
Lovely, Savoy said dryly.
Savoy, Willem, Simon, and I were sitting at an out-of-the-way table in the back of Anchors, isolated from the felling night crowd that filled the room with a low roar of conversation. My stitches had come out 2 days earlier, and we were celebrating my first full span in the Arcanum. We were none of us particularly drunk, but then again, none of us were particularly sober either. Our exact positioning between those two points is a matter of pointless conjecture, and I will waste no time on it.
I simply concentrate on being brilliant, Savoy said, then wait for the masters to realize it.
How did that work out with Mandrag?
Willem said with a rare smile. Savoy gave Willem a dark look.
Mandrag is a horse's ass.
That explains why you threatened him with your riding crop, Willem said.
I covered my mouth to stifle a laugh.
Did you really?
They're not telling the whole story, Savoy said, affronted. He passed me over for promotion in favor of another student. He was keeping me back so he could use me as indentured labor rather than raise me to Relar.
And you threatened him with your crop.
We had an argument, Savoy said calmly, and I happened to have my crop in my hand.
You waved it at him, Willem said.
I'd been riding, Savoy said hotly. If I'd been whoring before class and waved a corset at him, no one would have thought twice about it.
There was a moment of silence at our table. I'm thinking twice about it right now, Simmons said before bursting into laughter with Willem. Savoy fought down a smile as he turned to face me.
Sim is right about one thing. You should concentrate your efforts on one subject, otherwise you'll end up like Manat the Eternal Ilir.
He stood and straightened his clothes.
Now, how do I look?
Savoy wasn't fashionably dressed in the strictest sense, as he clung to the Modegan styles rather than the local ones, but there was no denying that he cut quite a figure in the muted colors of his fine silks and suedes.
"What does it matter?" Willem asked. "Are you trying to set up a tryst with Sim?"
Savoy smiled.
"Unfortunately, I must leave you. I have an engagement with a lady, and I doubt our rounds will bring us to this side of town tonight."
"You didn't tell us you had a date," Sim protested. We can't play corners with just three. It was something of a concession that Savoy was here with us at all. He'd sniffed a bit at Will and Sim's choice of taverns. Anchors was low class enough so that the drinks were cheap, but high class enough so that you didn't have to worry about someone picking a fight or throwing up on you. I liked it.
You are good friends and good company, Savoy said, but none of you are female. Nor, with the possible exception of Simon, are you lovely,
Savoy winked at him.
Honestly, who among you wouldn't throw the others over if there was a lady waiting?
We murmured a grudging agreement. Savoy smiled. His teeth were very white and straight.
I'll send the girl over with more drinks, he said as he turned to go, to ease the bitter sting of my departure.
He's not a bad sort, I mused after he left.
for nobility.
Willem nodded.
It's like he knows he's better than you, but doesn't look down on you for it because he knows it's not your fault.
So, who are you going to cozy up to? Sim asked, resting his elbows on the table. I'm guessing not him.
Or Lauren, I said bitterly. Damn Ambrose 12 ways. I would have loved to work in the archives.
Brandur's out too, Sim said. If Hem has a grudge, Brandur helps him carry it.
How about the Chancellor?
Willem asked.
Linguistics? You already speak Siaru, even if your accent is barbaric.
I shook my head. What about Mandrag? I've got a lot of experience with chemistry. It'd be just a small step into alchemy.
Simon laughed. Everyone thinks chemistry and alchemy are so similar, but they're really not. They're not even related. They just happen to live in the same house.
Willem gave a slow nod.
That's a nice way of putting it.
Besides, Simon said, Mandrag brought in about 20 new Elir last term. I heard him complaining about how crowded things were.
You've got a long haul if you go through Medica, Willem said. Arwill is stubborn as pig iron. There is no bending him.
He made a gesture with his hands as if chopping something into sections while he spoke.
6 terms Elir, 8 terms Relar, 10 terms Elthe.
At least, Simon added, Mola's been a Relar with him for almost 3 years now. I tried to think of how I could come up with 6 years' worth of tuition. I might not have the patience for that, I said. The serving girl appeared with a tray of drinks. Anchor's was only half full, so she'd been running just enough to bring roses to her cheeks.
Your gentleman friend paid for this round and the next, she said.
I like Savoy more and more, Willem said.
However, she held Will's drink out of his reach, he didn't pay for putting his hand on my ass.
She looked each of us in the eye.
I'll trust the three of you to settle that debt before you leave.
Sim stammered an apology.
He doesn't mean... In his culture, that sort of thing is more common.
She rolled her eyes, her expression softening.
Well, in this culture, a healthy tip makes a fine apology.
She handed Will his drink and turned to leave, resting her empty tray on one hip. We watched her go, each of us thinking our own private thoughts.
I noticed he had his rings back, I mentioned eventually.
He played a brilliant round of Bassett last night, Simmons said.
Made 6 doublings in a row and cracked the bank.
To Savoy!
Willem held up his tin mug.
May his luck keep him in classes and us in drinks.
We toasted and drank, then Willem brought us back to the matter at hand.
That leaves you with Kilvin and Elxadal.
He held up 2 fingers.
What about Elodin? I interrupted.
They both gave me blank looks.
What about him? Sim asked.
He seems nice enough, I said. Couldn't I study under him?
Simon burst out laughing. Willem gave a rare grin.
What? I demanded. Elodin doesn't teach anything, Sim explained, except maybe advanced oddness.
He has to teach something, I protested. He's a master, isn't he?
Sim is right. Elodin is cramped.
Will tapped the side of his head.
Cracked,
Simon corrected.
Cracked,
Will repeated.
He does seem a little strange, I said.
You do pick things up quick, Willem said dryly. No wonder you made it into the Arcanum at such a tender age.
Ease off, Will. He's hardly been here a span. Simon turned to me. Elodin used to be Chancellor about 5 years ago.
Elodin?
I couldn't hide my incredulity. But he's so young, and... I trailed off, not wanting to say the first word that came to my mind. Crazy. Simon finished my sentence. Brilliant. And not that young if you consider that he was admitted to the university when he was barely 14.
Simon looked at me. He was a full arcanist by 18. Then he stayed around as a giller for a few years.
Giller?
I interrupted.
Gillers are arcanists who stay at the university, Will said. They do a lot of the teaching. You know, Kamar in the fishery?
I shook my head.
Tall, scarred.
Will gestured to one side of his face.
Only one eye?
I nodded somberly. Kamar was hard to miss. The left side of his face was a web of scars that radiated out, leaving bald strips running through his black hair and beard. He wore a patch over the hollow of his left eye. He was a walking object lesson about how dangerous work in the fishery could be.
I've seen him around. He's a full arcanist?
Will nodded.
He's Skilvan second in command. He teaches Sigildry to the newer students.
Sim cleared his throat. As I was saying, Elodin was the youngest ever admitted, youngest to make arcanist and youngest to be chancellor.
Even so, I said, you have to admit, he's a little odd to be chancellor.
Not back then, Simon said soberly. That was before it happened. When nothing more was forthcoming, I prompted.
It?
Will shrugged.
Something. They do not speak on it. They locked him in the crockery until he got most of his marbles back.
I don't like thinking about it, Simon said, shifting uncomfortably in his chair. I mean, a couple of students go crazy every term, right? He looked at Willem. Remember Slith?
Will nodded somberly.
It might happen to any of us.
There was a moment of silence as the two of them sipped their drinks, not looking at anything in particular. I wanted to ask for specifics, but I could tell that it was a touchy subject.
Anyway, Sim said in a low voice,
I heard they didn't let him out of the crockery. I heard he escaped. No arcanist worth his salt can be kept in a cell, I said.
That's not surprising.
Have you ever been there? Simon asked. It's built to keep arcanists locked up. All meshed stone. Wards on the doors and windows. He shook his head. I can't imagine how someone could get out, even one of the masters.
All this is beside the path,
Willem said firmly, bringing us back to task.
Kilvan has welcomed you to the fishery. Impressing him will be your best chance at making Relar.
He looked back and forth between us.
Agreed?
Agreed, Simon said. I nodded, but the wheels in my head were spinning. I was thinking about Tabberlin the Great, who knew the names of all things. I thought about the stories Scarpi had told back in Tarbian. He hadn't mentioned arcanists, only namers. And I thought of Elodin, Master Namer, and how I might approach him. Chapter 45. Interlude. Some Tavern Tale. At a gesture from Quoth, Chronicler wiped off the nib of his pen and shook out his hand. Bast gave a great seated stretch, his arms arching over the back of the chair.
I'd almost forgotten how quickly it all happened, Quoth mused. Those were probably the first stories anyone ever told about me.
They're still telling them at the university, Chronicler said. I've heard 3 different versions of the class you taught. Your whipping, too. Is that when they started calling you Quoth the Bloodless?
Quoth nodded.
Possibly.
If we're asking questions, Reshi, Bast said sheepishly, I was wondering why you didn't go looking for Scarpi.
What could I have done, Bast? Smeared my face with lampblack and staged a daring midnight rescue?
Quoth gave a brief humorless laugh.
They'd taken him in on heresy. All I could do was hope he truly had friends in the church.
Quoth drew a deep breath and sighed.
But the simplest reason is the least satisfying one, I suppose. The truth is this. I wasn't living in a story.
I don't think I'm understanding you, Reshi, Bast said, puzzled.
Think of all the stories you've heard, Bast. You have a young boy, the hero.
His parents are killed. He sets out for vengeance. What happens next?
Bast hesitated, his expression puzzled. Chronicler answered the question instead.
He finds help. A clever talking squirrel, an old drunken swordsman, a mad hermit in the woods, that sort of thing.
Quoth nodded.
Exactly. He finds the mad hermit in the woods, proves himself worthy, and learns the names of all things, just like Tamerlan the Great. Then, with these powerful magics at his beck and call, what does he do?
Chronicler shrugged.
He finds the villains and kills them.
Of course, Quoth said grandly. Clean, quick, and easy as lying. We know how it ends practically before it starts. That's why stories appeal to us. They give us the clarity and simplicity our real lives lack.
Quoth leaned forward. If this were some tavern tale, all half-truth and senseless adventure, I would tell you how my time at the university was spent with a purity of dedication. I would learn the ever-changing name of the wind, ride out, and gain my revenge against the Chandrian.
Quoth snapped his fingers sharply.
Simple as that. But while that might make for an entertaining story, it would not be the truth. The truth is this. I had mourned my parents' death for 3 years, and the pain of it had faded to a dull ache.
Quoth made a conciliatory gesture with one hand, and smiled a tight smile.
I won't lie to you. There were times late at night when I lay sleepless and desperately alone in my narrow bunk in the mews. Times when I was choked with a sorrow so endless and empty I thought it would smother me. There were times when I would see a mother holding her child, or a father laughing with his son, and anger would flare up in me, hot and furious with the memory of blood and the smell of burning hair.
Quoth shrugged. But there was more to my life than revenge. I had very real obstacles to overcome close at hand. My poverty, my low birth, the enemies I made at the university were more dangerous to me than any of the Chandrian.
He gestured for Chronicler to pick up his pen. But for all that, we still see that even the most fanciful of stories hold a shred of truth, because I did find something very near to the mad hermit in the woods.
Quoth smiled.
And I was determined to learn the name of the wind.
Chapter 46 The Ever-Changing Wind. Illodin proved a difficult man to find. He had an office in Hollows, but never seemed to use it. When I visited ledgers and lists, I discovered he only taught one class, unlikely maths. However, this was less than helpful in tracking him down, as according to the ledger, the time of the class was now, and the location was everywhere. In the end, I spotted him through sheer luck across a crowded courtyard. He was wearing his black master's robes, which was something of a rarity. I was on my way to the Medica for observation, but decided I'd rather be late for my class than miss the opportunity to speak with him. By the time I struggled through the midday crowd and caught up with him, we were on the northern edge of the university, following a wide dirt road that led into the forest.
"Master Illodin," I said, pelting up to him. "I was hoping I could talk with you." "A sad little hope," he said without breaking stride or looking in my direction. "You should aim higher. A young man ought to be afire with high ambitions." "I hope to study naming, then," I said, falling into step beside him. "Too high," he said matter-of-factly. "Try again, somewhere in between."
The dirt road curved, and the trees blocked the sight of the university's buildings behind us.
"I hope you'll accept me as a student," I tried again, "and teach me whatever you think best."
Illodin stopped walking abruptly and turned to face me.
"Fine," he said. "Go find me 3 pine cones. He made a circle with his thumb and finger. "This big, without any of the little bits broken off."
He sat down right in the middle of the road and made a shooing motion with his hand.
"Go on, hurry!"
I darted off into the surrounding trees. It took me about 5 minutes to find 3 pine cones of the appropriate type. By the time I got back to the road, I was disheveled and bramble-scratched. Illodin was nowhere to be seen.
I looked around stupidly, then cursed, dropped the pine cones, and took off running, following the road north. I caught up with him fairly quickly, as he was just idling along, looking at the trees.
"So, what did you learn?" Elodin asked.
"That you want to be left alone?"
"You are quick!"
He spread his arms dramatically and intoned.
"Here endeth the lesson. Here endeth my profound tutelage of Ilir Kvothe."
I sighed. If I left now, I could still catch my class in the Medica, but part of me suspected that this might be a test of some sort. Perhaps Elodin was simply making sure that I was genuinely interested before he accepted me as a student. That is the way it usually goes in stories. The young man has to prove his dedication to the old hermit in the woods before he's taken under his wing.
"Will you answer a few questions?" I asked.
"Fine," he said, holding up his hand with his thumb and forefinger curled in.
"Three questions, if you agree to leave me be afterward."
I thought for a moment.
"Why don't you want to teach me?"
"Because the Ademaru make exceptionally poor students," he said brusquely. "They are fine for rote learning, but the study of naming requires a level of dedication that rabble such as yourself rarely possess."
My temper flared so hot and quick that I actually felt my skin flush. It started at my face and burned down my chest and arms. It made the hair on my arms prickle. I took a deep breath.
"I'm sorry that your experience with the Rue has left something to be desired," I said carefully. "Let me assure you that—"
"Ye gods!" Elodin sighed, disgusted. "A bootlicker, too? You lack the requisite spine and testicular fortitude to study under me."
Hot words boiled up inside me. I fought them down. He was trying to bait me.
"You aren't telling me the truth," I said. "Why don't you want to teach me?"
"For the same reason I don't want a puppy," Elodin shouted, waving his arms in the air like a farmer trying to startle crows out of a field. "Because you're too short to be a namer. Your eyes are too green. You have the wrong number of fingers. Come back when you're taller and you've found a decent pair of eyes." We stared at each other for a long while. Finally, he shrugged and started walking again.
"Fine. I'll show you why."
We followed the road north. Elodin strolled along, picking up stones and tossing them into the trees. He jumped to snatch leaves from low-hanging branches, his master's robes billowing ridiculously. At one point, he stopped and stood motionless and intent for nearly half an hour, staring at a fern swaying slowly in the wind. But I kept the tip of my tongue firmly between my teeth. I didn't ask, "Where are we going?" or "What are you looking at?" I knew 100 stories about young boys who squandered questions or wishes by chatting them away. I had 2 questions left, and I was going to make them count. Eventually, we emerged from the forest, and the road became a path leading up a vast lawn to a huge manor house. Bigger than the artificery, it had elegant lines, a red tile roof, high windows, arched doorways and pillars. There were fountains, flowers, hedges. But something wasn't quite right. The closer we got to the gates, the more I doubted this was some nobleman's estate. Maybe it was something about the design of the gardens, or the fact that the wrought iron fence surrounding the lawns was nearly 10 feet tall and unclimbable to my well-trained thief's eye. 2 serious-eyed men opened the gate, and we continued up the path toward the front doors. Elodin looked at me.
"Have you heard of Haven yet?"
I shook my head. "It has other names. The Rookery, the Crockery."
"The University Asylum. It's huge. How—"
I stopped before asking the question. Elodin grinned, knowing he'd almost caught me.
"Jeremy?" he called out to the large man who stood at the front door. "How many guests do we have today?"
"The desk could give you a count, sir," he said uncomfortably.
"Take a wild guess," Elodin said. "We're all friends here."
320,
the man said with a shrug.
350?
Elodin rapped on the thick timber door with a knuckle, and the man scrambled to unlock it.
"How many more could we fit if we needed?" Elodin asked him.
"Another 150 easy," Jeremy said, tugging the huge door open.
"More in a pinch, I suppose."
"See, Quoth?" Elodin winked at me.
"We're ready."
The entryway was huge, with stained glass windows and vaulted ceilings. The floor was marble polished to a mirror sheen. The place was eerily silent. I couldn't understand it. The Reftview Asylum in Tarbian was only a fraction of the size of this place, and it sounded like a brothel full of angry cats. You could hear it from a mile away over the din of the city. Elodin strolled up to a large desk where a young woman stood.
"Why isn't anyone outside, Emmy?"
She gave an uneasy smile.
"They're too wild today, sir. We think there's a storm coming in."
She pulled a ledger book off the shelf.
"The moon's getting full, too. You know how it gets."
"Sure do."
Elodin crouched down and began to unlace his shoes.
"Where did they stash Wynn this time?"
She flipped a few pages in the ledger.
"Second floor east, 247.
Elodin stood back up and set his shoes on the desk.
"Keep an eye on these, would you?"
She gave him an uncertain smile and nodded. I choked down another mouthful of questions.
"It seems like the university goes to an awful lot of expense here," I commented.
Elodin ignored me and turned to climb a wide marble staircase in his stocking feet. Then we entered a long white hallway lined with wooden doors. For the first time, I could hear the sounds I had expected in a place like this. Moans, weeping, incessant chattering, screaming, all very faint. Elodin ran for a few steps, then stopped, his stocking feet gliding across the smooth marble floor, his master's robe streaming out behind him. He repeated this, a few quick steps, then a long slide with his arms held out to the sides for balance. I continued to pace along beside him.
"I'd think the masters would find other more academic uses for the university's funds."
Elodin didn't look at me. Step, 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 step.
"You're trying to get me to answer questions you're not asking. Slide. It's not going to work."
"You're trying to trick me into asking questions," I pointed out. "It seems only fair." Step, 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 slide.
"So why the hell are you bothering with me anyway?"
Elodin asked.
"Kelvin likes you well enough. Why not hitch your star to his wagon?"
"I think you know things I can't learn anywhere else."
"Things like what?"
"Things I've wanted to know since I first saw someone call the wind."
"Name of the wind, was it?"
Elodin raised his eyebrows. Step, 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 step.
"That's tricky.
Slide.
What makes you think I know anything about calling the wind?"
"Process of elimination," I said. "None of the other masters do that sort of thing, so it must be your bailiwick."
"By your logic, I should also be in charge of solenade dances, needlework, and horse thieving."
We came to the end of the hall. Mid-slide, Elodin nearly bowled over a huge, broad-shouldered man carrying a hardback.
"Beg your pardon, sir,"
he said, though it obviously wasn't his fault.
"Timothy!"
Elodin pointed a long finger at him.
"Come with us."
Elodin led the way through several shorter hallways, eventually coming to a heavy wooden door with a sliding panel at eye level. Elodin opened it and peered through.
"How's he been?"
"Quiet,"
the hulking man said.
"I don't think he's slept much."
Elodin tried the latch, then turned to the broad-shouldered man, his face going grim.
"You locked him in?"
The man stood a full head taller than Elodin and probably weighed twice as much, but the blood drained from his face as the shoeless master glared at him.
"Not me, Master Elodin. It's..."
Elodin cut him off with a sharp gesture.
"Unlock it!"
Timothy fumbled with a ring of keys. Elodin continued to stare him down.
"Alder Wynn is not to be confined. He may come and go as he pleases. Nothing is to be put in his food unless he specifically asks for it,
I'm holding you responsible for this, Timothy Jenneroy.
Elladan poked him in the chest with a long finger. If I find out that Wynne has been sedated or restrained, I'll ride you naked through the streets of Imray like a little pink pony. He glared. Go! The fellow left as quickly as he could manage without actually breaking into a run. Elodin turned to me. You can come in, but don't make any noises or sudden movements. Don't talk unless he talks to you. If you do talk, keep your voice low. Understand? I nodded, and he opened the door. The room wasn't what I'd expected. Tall windows let the daylight in, revealing a sizable bed and a table with chairs. The walls, ceiling, and floor were all padded with thick white cloth, muffling even the faint noises from the hallway. The blankets had been pulled off the bed, and a thin man of about 30 was bundled up in them, huddled against the wall. Elodin closed the door, and the mousy man flinched a little.
Wynn?
He said softly, moving closer. What happened?
Alder Wynne looked up owlishly. A thin stick of a man, he was bare-chested under the blanket, his hair in wild disarray, his eyes round and wide. He spoke softly, his voice cracking a little.
I was fine. I was doing fine. But all the people talking, dogs, cobblestones. I just can't be around that right now.
Wynne pressed himself against the wall, and the blanket fell off his bony shoulder. I was startled to see a lead guilder around his neck. This man was a full-fledged arcanist.
Elodin nodded.
Why are you on the floor?
Wynne looked over at the bed, panic in his eyes.
I'll fall,
he said softly, his voice somewhere between horror and embarrassment.
And there are springs and slats, nails.
How are you now? Elodin asked gently. Would you like to come back with me?
No!
Wynne gave a hopeless, despairing cry, screwing his eyes closed and pulling the blanket closer around himself. His thin, reedy voice made his plea more heart-wrenching than if he'd howled it. It's fine. You can stay, Elodin said softly. I'll be back to visit.
Wynne opened his eyes at this, looking agitated.
Don't bring thunder,
he said urgently. He reached one thin hand out of his blanket and clutched at Elodin's shirt.
But I do need a cat whistle and blue down, and bones, too.
His tone was urgent.
Tent bones.
I'll bring them, Elodin reassured him, gesturing for me to back out of the room. I did.
Elodin closed the door behind us, his expression grim. Wynne knew what he was getting into when he became my giller. He turned and began to walk down the hall.
You don't. You don't know anything about the university, about the risks involved. You think this place is a fairyland, a playground. It's not.
That's right, I snapped.
It's a playground, and all the other children are jealous because I got to play Get Whipped Bloody and banned from the archive, and they didn't.
Elodin stopped walking and turned to look at me.
Fine. Prove me wrong. Prove that you've thought this through. Why does a university with under 1,500 students need an asylum the size of the Royal Palace?
My mind raced.
Most students are from well-to-do families, I said. They've led easy lives. When forced to wrong,
Elodin said dismissively, turning to walk down the hall.
It is because of what we study, because of the way we train our minds to move.
So ciphering and grammar make people crazy, I said, taking care to phrase it as a statement. Elodin stopped walking and wrenched open the nearest door. Panicked screaming burst out into the hallway.
In me! They're in me! They're in me! They're in me!
Through the open door, I could see a young man thrashing against the leather restraints that bound him to the bed at wrist, waist, neck, and ankle.
Trigonometry and diagrammed logic don't do this, Elodin said, looking me in the eye.
They're in me! They're in me! They're in...
The screaming continued in an unbroken chant, like the endless, mindless barking of a dog at night.
Me! They're in me! They're in me! They're in...
Elodin closed the door.
though I could still hear the screaming faintly through the thick door, the near silence was stunning.
"Do you know why they call this place the Rookery?" Elodin asked.
I shook my head.
"Because it's where you go if you're a raven." He smiled a wild smile. He laughed a terrible laugh.
Elodin led me through a long series of hallways to a different wing of the crockery. Finally, we turned a corner and I saw something new, a door made entirely of copper. Elodin took a key from his pocket and unlocked it.
"I like to stop in when I'm back in the neighborhood," he said casually as he opened the door. "Check my mail, water the plants and such."
He pulled off one of his socks, tied a knot in it, and used it to wedge the door open.
"It's a nice place to visit, but, you know."
He tugged on the door, making sure it wouldn't swing closed.
"Not again."
The first thing I noticed about the room was something strange about the air. At first, I thought it might be soundproof, like Alder Wynn's, but looking around, I saw the walls and ceilings were bare gray stone. Next, I thought the air might be stale, except when I drew a breath, I smelled lavender and fresh linen. It was almost like there was a pressure on my ears, as if I were deep underwater, except, of course, that I wasn't. I waved a hand in front of me, almost expecting the air to feel different, thicker. It didn't.
"Pretty irritating, huh?"
I turned around to see Elodin watching me.
"I'm surprised you noticed, actually. Not many do."
The room was a definite step above Alder Wynn's. It had a four-post bed with curtains, an overstuffed couch, an empty bookcase, and a large table with several chairs. Most notable were the huge windows looking out over the lawns and gardens. I could see a balcony outside, but there didn't seem to be any way to get to it.
"Watch this," Elodin said. He picked up one of the high-backed wooden chairs, lifted it with both hands, spun in a circle, and flung it hard at the window. I cringed, but instead of a terrible crash, there was just a dull splintering of wood. The chair fell to the floor in a ruined tangle of timber and upholstery.
"I used to do that for hours," Elodin said, drawing a deep breath and looking around the room fondly.
"Good times."
I went to look at the windows. They were thicker than usual, but not that thick. They seemed normal except for faint reddish streaks running through them. I glanced at the window frame. It was copper, too. I looked slowly around at the room, eyeing its bare stone walls, feeling its strangely heavy air. I noticed the door didn't even have a handle on the inside, let alone a lock. Why would anyone go through all the trouble of making a solid copper door? I decided on my second question.
"How did you get out?"
"Finally," Elodin said with a tinge of exasperation. He slouched onto the couch. "You see, once upon a time, Elodin the Great found himself locked in a high tower." He gestured to the room around us. "He had been stripped of his tools, his coin, key, and candle. Furthermore, his cell had no door worth mentioning, no window that could be breached." He made dismissive gestures at each of these. "Even the name of the wind was hidden from him by the clever machinations of his captors." Elodin got up from the couch and began to pace the room. All around him was nothing but smooth, hard stone. It was a cell no man had ever escaped. He stopped pacing and held up a finger dramatically. "But Elodin the Great knew the names of all things, and so all things were his to command. He faced the great wall beside the windows. He said to the stone, 'Break!' And the—" Elodin trailed off, his head tilting to one side curiously. His eyes narrowed.
"Sod me, they changed it,"
he said quietly to himself.
"Huh."
He stepped closer to the wall and lay a hand on it. I let my attention wander. Will and Sim had been right. The man was cracked in his head. What would happen if I ran out of the room, unstuck the door, and slammed it?
Would the other masters thank me?
Oh, Elodin said suddenly, laughing. That was half clever of them.
He took two steps back from the wall.
Sire Basalion!
I saw the wall move. It rippled like a hanging rug thumped with a stick. Then it simply fell, like dark water poured from a bucket. Tons of fine gray sand spilled across the floor in a sudden rush, burying Elodin's feet up to his shins. Sunlight and birdsong poured into the room. Where there had been a foot of solid gray stone before, there was now a gaping hole big enough to drive a cart through. But the hole wasn't completely clear. Some green material was spread across the opening. It almost looked like a dirty, tangled net, but it was too irregular for netting. It was more like a thick, tattered cobweb.
That wasn't there before,
Elodin said apologetically as he pulled his feet free of the gray sand. It was much more dramatic the first time, let me assure you. I simply stood, stunned by what I'd just seen. This wasn't sympathy. This wasn't anything I'd ever seen before. All I could think of was the old line from 100 half-remembered stories. And Taberlin the Great said to the stone, "Break," and the stone broke. Elodin wrenched off one of the chair's legs and used it to batter at the tangled green web that stretched across the opening. Parts of it broke easily or flaked away. Where it was thicker, he used the leg as a lever to bend pieces aside. Where it bent or broke, it glimmered bright in the sunlight. More copper, I thought. Veins of copper running through the blocks of stone that made the wall. Elodin dropped the chair leg and ducked through the gap. Through the window, I saw him lean against the white stone railing on the balcony. I followed him outside. As soon as I stepped onto the balcony, the air no longer felt strangely heavy and still. 2 years, he said, looking out over the gardens. Able to see this balcony, but not stand on it. Able to see the wind, but not hear it, not feel it on my face. He swung one leg up over the stone railing, so he was sitting on it, then dropped a few feet to land on the flat piece of roof just underneath. He wandered out across the roof, away from the building. I hopped the rail myself and followed him to the edge of the roof. We were only about 20 feet up, but the gardens and fountains spreading out on all sides made for a spectacular view. Elodin stood perilously near the edge, his master's robe flapping around him like a dark flag. He looked rather impressive, actually, if you were willing to ignore the fact that he was still only wearing one sock. I went to stand beside him on the edge of the roof. I knew what my third question had to be. "What do I have to do," I asked, "to study naming under you?" He met my eye calmly, appraising me. "Jump," he said. "Jump off this roof." That's when I realized that all of this had been a test. Elodin had been taking my measure ever since we met. He had a grudging respect for my tenacity, and he had been surprised that I noticed something odd about the air in his room. He was on the verge of accepting me as a student. But he needed more. Proof of my dedication. A demonstration. A leap of faith. And as I stood there, a piece of story came to mind. So Taberlin fell, but he did not despair, for he knew the name of the wind. And so the wind obeyed him. It cradled and caressed him. It bore him to the ground as gently as a puff of thistledown. It set him on his feet softly as a mother's kiss. Elodin knew the name of the wind. Still looking him in the eye, I stepped off the edge of the roof. Elodin's expression was marvelous. I have never seen a man so astonished. I spun slightly as I fell, so he stayed in my line of vision. I saw him raise one hand slightly, as if making a belated attempt to grab hold of me. I felt weightless, like I was floating. Then I struck the ground. Not gently, like a feather settling down. Hard, like a brick hitting a cobblestone street.
I landed on my back with my left arm beneath me. My vision went dark as the back of my head struck the ground and all the air was driven from my body. I didn't lose consciousness. I just lay there, breathless and unable to move. I remember thinking, quite earnestly, that I was dead, that I was blind. Eventually, my sight returned, leaving me blinking against the sudden brightness of the blue sky. Pain tore through my shoulder, and I tasted blood. I couldn't breathe. I tried to roll off my arm, but my body wouldn't listen to me. I had broken my neck. My back! After a long, terrifying moment, I managed to gasp a shallow breath, then another. I gave a sigh of relief and realized that I had at least one broken rib in addition to everything else. But I moved my fingers slightly, then my toes. They worked. I hadn't broken my spine. As I lay there, counting my blessings and broken ribs, Elodin stepped into my field of vision. He looked down at me. "Congratulations," he said. "That was the stupidest thing I've ever seen." His expression was a mix of awe and disbelief. Ever! And that is when I decided to pursue the noble art of artificing. Not that I had a lot of other options. Before helping me limp to the Medica, Elodin made it clear that anyone stupid enough to jump off a roof was too reckless to be allowed to hold a spoon in his presence, let alone study something as profound and volatile as naming. Nevertheless, I wasn't terribly put out by Elodin's refusal. Storybook magic or no, I was not eager to study under a man whose first set of lessons had left me with 3 broken ribs, a mild concussion, and a dislocated shoulder. Chapter 47. Barbs. Aside from its rocky start, my first term went fairly smoothly. I studied in the Medica, learning more about the body and how to heal it. I practiced my Siaru with Willem and helped him with his Aeturin in exchange. I joined the ranks of the artificery, studying how to blow glass, mix alloys, draw wire, inscribe metal and sculpt stone. Most evenings I came back to Kilvin's workshop to work. I chipped casings off bronze castings, washed glassware, and ground ore for alloys. It was not demanding work, but every span Kilvin gave me a copper jot, sometimes 2. I suspected there was a great tally board in that methodical mind of his, carefully marking down the hours each person worked. I learned things of a less academic nature as well. Some of my Arcanum bunkmates taught me a card game called Dog's Breath. I returned the favor by giving an impromptu lesson in psychology, probability, and manual dexterity. I won almost 2 whole talents before they stopped inviting me back to their games. I became tight friends with Willem and Simon. I had some few others, but not many, and none so close as Will and Sim. My swift rise to Elir alienated me from most of the other students. Whether they resented or admired me, most students held themselves apart. And there was Ambrose. To deem us simply enemies is to lose the true flavor of our relationship. It was more like the two of us entered into a business partnership in order to more efficiently pursue our mutual interest of hating each other. However, even with my vendetta against Ambrose, I still had a great deal of time on my hands. Since I wasn't able to spend it in the archives, I spent some time nurturing my budding reputation. You see, my dramatic entrance to the university had made quite a stir. I'd made my way into the Arcanum in 3 days instead of the usual 3 terms. I was the youngest member by almost 2 years. I had openly defied one of the masters in front of his own class and avoided expulsion. When whipped, I hadn't cried out or bled. On top of everything else, I had apparently managed to infuriate Master Elodin to such an extent that he had thrown me off the roof of the crockery. I let that story circulate uncorrected, as it was preferable to the embarrassing truth. Altogether, it was enough to start a steady stream of rumor around me, and I decided to take advantage of it. Reputation is like a sort of armor, or a weapon you can brandish if need be. I decided that if I was going to be an arcanist, I might as well be a well-known arcanist. So I let slip a few pieces of information. I had been admitted without a letter of recommendation. The masters had given me 3 talents to attend, rather than make me pay a tuition. I had survived for years on the streets of Tarbian, living off my wits. I even started a few rumors that were pure nonsense, lies so outrageous that people would repeat them despite the fact that they were obviously untrue. I had demon blood in me. I could see in the dark. I only slept an hour each night. When the moon was full, I would talk in my sleep, speaking a strange language no one could understand. Basil, my former bunkmate from Muse, helped me start these rumors. I would make up the stories, he would tell a few people, then together we would watch them spread like a fire in a field. It was an amusing hobby. But my ongoing feud with Ambrose added to my reputation more than anything else. Everyone was stunned that I dared openly defy a powerful noble's firstborn son. We had several dramatic encounters that first term. I won't bore you with the details. We'd crossed paths, and he would make some offhand comment loud enough for everyone in the room to hear, or he would sneer at me under the guise of a compliment. "You must tell me who cuts your hair." Anyone with a lick of common sense knew how to deal with arrogant nobility. The tailor I had terrorized back in Tarbian knew what to do. You take your lumps, duck your head, and get the whole thing over as quickly as possible. But I always fought back, and while Ambrose was intelligent and reasonably well-spoken, he was no match for my trooper's tongue. I had been raised on the stage, and my sharp rue wits ensured that I got the better of our exchanges. Still, Ambrose continued to seek me out, like a dog too stupid to avoid a porcupine. He would snap at me and leave with a face full of barbs. And each time we parted ways, we hated each other just a little more. People noticed, and by the end of the term, I had a reputation for reckless bravery. But the truth is, I was merely fearless. There is a difference, you see. In Tarbian, I'd learned real fear. I feared hunger, pneumonia, guards with hobnail boots, older boys with bottle glass knives. Confronting Ambrose required no real bravery on my part. I simply couldn't muster any fear of him. I saw him as a puffed-up clown. I thought he was harmless. I was a fool. Chapter 48. Interlude. A silence of a different kind. Bast sat in the Waystone Inn and tried to keep his hands motionless in his lap. He had counted 15 breaths since Quoth had spoken last, and the innocent silence that had gathered like a clear pool around the 3 men was beginning to darken into a silence of a different kind. Bast took another breath. 16. And braced himself against the moment he feared would come. It would not be to Bast's credit to say that he was afraid of nothing, as only fools and priests are never afraid. But it is true that very few things unnerved him. Heights, for instance, he didn't care for very much, and the great summer storms that came through these parts that blackened the sky and tore up deep-rooted oaks made him feel uncomfortably small and helpless. But when you came down to it, nothing really frightened him. Not storms, not tall ladders, not even the Skrail. Bast was brave by being largely fearless. Nothing would turn him pale, or if it did, he didn't stay pale for very long. Oh, certainly, he didn't relish the thought of someone hurting him, stabbing him with bitter iron, searing him with hot coals, that sort of thing. But just because he didn't like the thought of his blood on the outside didn't mean he was really afraid of those things. He just didn't want them to happen. To really fear something, you have to dwell on it. And since there was nothing that preyed on Bast's waking mind in this fashion, there was nothing his heart truly feared. But hearts can change. 10 years ago, he had lost his grip climbing a tall rennel tree to pick fruit for a girl he fancied. After he slipped, he had hung for a long minute,
head down, before falling. In that long minute, a small fear rooted inside him and had stayed with him ever since. In the same way, Bast had learned a new fear of late. A year ago, he had been fearless, as any sane man can hope to be. But now, Bast feared silence. Not the ordinary silence that came from a simple absence of things moving about and making noise. Bast feared the deep, weary silence that gathered around his master at times, like an invisible shroud. Bast breathed in again. 17. He fought not to wring his hands as he waited for the deep silence to invade the room. He waited for it to crystallize and show its teeth on the edges of the cool quiet that had pooled in the waystone. He knew how it came, like the frost that bleeds out of the winter ground, hardening the clear water that an early thaw leaves in wagon ruts. But before Bast could draw another breath, Kvolth straightened in his chair and made a motion for Chronicler to lay down his pen. Bast nearly wept as he sensed the silence scatter, like a dark bird startled into flight. Kvolth gave a sigh that hovered between annoyance and resignation. "I will admit," he said, "that I am not sure how to approach the next part of the story." Afraid to let the silence stretch for too long, Bast chirruped, "Why don't you simply talk about what is most important first? Then you can go back and touch on other things, if you need to." "As if it were as simple as that," Kvolth said sharply. "What is most important? My magic or my music? My triumphs or my follies?" Bast flushed a deep crimson and bit his lips. Kvolth let out his breath in a sudden rush. "I'm sorry, Bast. It's good advice, as all of your seemingly inane advice turns out to be." He pushed his chair back from the table. "But before we continue, the real world has certain calls on me that I can no longer ignore. If you will please excuse me for a moment." Chronicler and Bast stood as well, stretching their legs and attending to calls of their own. Bast lit the lamps. Kvolth produced more cheese and bread and hard spiced sausage. They ate, and some small effort was made at polite conversation, but their minds were elsewhere, dwelling on the story. Bast ate half of everything. Chronicler accounted for a sizable, though more modest, amount. Kvolth had a bite or two before he spoke. "Onward, then. Music and magic. Triumph and folly. Think now, what does our story need? What vital element is it lacking?"
"Women, Reshi,"
Bast said immediately. "There's a real paucity of women." Kvolth smiled. "Not women, Bast. A woman. The woman." Kvolth looked at Chronicler. "You have heard bits and pieces, I don't doubt. I will tell you the truth of her, though I fear I may not be equal to the challenge." Chronicler picked up his pen, but before he could dip it, Kvolth held up a hand. "Let me say one thing before I start. I've told stories in the past, painted pictures with words, told hard lies and harder truths. Once I sang colors to a blind man. 7 hours I played, but at the end he said he saw them, green and red and gold. That, I think, was easier than this. Trying to make you understand her with nothing more than words. You have never seen her, never heard her voice. You cannot know." Kvolth motioned for Chronicler to pick up his pen. "But still, I will try. She is in the wings now, waiting for her cue. Let us set the stage for her arrival."